to be a god. Starting now, I'll do everything as if I were a god. I'll walk from a dark room as a god walks from a dark room. I'll speak to strangers as a god speaks to strangers. When it's time to say something important, I'll rise from my chair as a god would and speak in my celestial certitudes. There will be no more lap-sitting, no more stories about my days as a barback or a ferryman or a farrier. There will be fewer hours spent tuning my piano and patting my hunting dogs or remembering my youth. When I need you to hurt, I'll put you to sleep as a god puts you to sleep. I'll play my discordant harp as a god plays a harp, and the effects will be the same. The noise of the bramble never leaves me. I bless the cedar, the months go by. I bless your saw. When you need me to hurt, I'll dim in the linden leaves. I'll hide in the fire-scarred hills. And the great guards of my gilded name will circle around to protect me. And you'll be there. And I'll know your name as a god knows your name, as a father knows your name. But you won't recognize me. I always feel like I have to read that poem because it's the oldest poem in the book. I wrote it the day after I handed in my MFA thesis, which I promptly threw in the trash. So it's kind of the beginning of this book. The mistake. You and I have likely a very different understanding of why we've made the mistake of coming here, of journeying all this way, by which I mean peering through the window of this one-room cabin called Now, or Earth, or Love, just to sprawl our tired limbs on a stranger's disturbingly beige carpet. Nevertheless, I often find myself wondering about the not-so-innocent lives of oil paintings, the awfully blue horses kneeling in their shade, the way their impossible green goes on living, never standing a chance of learning how awkwardly similar they are to us. And I forget us, as this snow is forgetting this street lamp, these power lines, as these unsuspecting farmers rust in their fields and never know they were part of something too important to see, a part of time, which is a part of me, a form of struggle, itself becoming struggle, and ending in a courage to surrender to a will remarkably not one's own, a shock of crows lifting from the hand of a tree, or a tree lifting from the hand of no one you know. So, a little bit about the title to the book, Not on the Last Day, but on the Very Last. It comes from a parable called Coming of the Messiah. It's a Kafka parable. And the parable is very short, and it ends in these three paradoxes. The Messiah will come on the day after he is no longer required. He will come on the day after his arrival. He will come not on the last day, but on the very last. And I'd read the parable a number of times and kind of fell in love with it all over again, listening to Judith Butler talk about it. There's this great video of her lecturing on it, kind of off the cuff. She's just like thinking about it out loud to these French university students. And she's negotiating those last paradoxes. And of course, you know, to kind of make sense of a paradox, you have to change the semantic value of one of the variables. And so when she gets to that last paradox, she's changing last day to mean maybe not the last day, the day we thought was the last day, but not quite the last day, or the very last, as in maybe somehow this moment that this paradox is describing is outside of our normal conception of time. But the variable that she didn't manipulate was the coming part. And to me, Kafka, being a Jew writing in the context of this Christian space, it seems very likely to me that it's a Messiah that comes to save us by not coming. And that seemed to kind of define a lot of what these speakers are doing. They're both total megalomaniacs, and they're also extremely self-deprecating. And I think, you know, to have the gall to publish a book or write poems at all requires probably both of those things simultaneously. Then after I finished, after the pegs were good and in the ground, I stayed under the empty circus tent, and I sat like a nail at the edge of the center ring. I didn't know what to say. Hours passed. I sat there. Then, out of nowhere, a lioness entered the ring. And with my hands on her waist, her claws shining on my shoulders, we forgot the dance we'd meant to dance. But we danced, kicked circles in the sod, imagined the children, the families, all filling the vacant bleachers, the ringmaster lifting a bullhorn to his wretched mouth. We would have taken a bow in the spotlight had a spotlight been shining on us. But we were glad to be rid of ourselves, even for a moment, glad to dance the dance that made our irrelevance more real, though our limbs lacked grace, especially mine. Or maybe it was the dance itself that lacked grace. But we were glad to be part of the show, or part of the dance whose primitive lunges and flailing we repeated. And though the swaying couldn't be our own, though we would have never thought to move this way, we kept dancing. We heard the loose sound of a church bell whose cargo jangled each night through the streets. And after that, the far off celebration of wolves or dogs or freaks wafting through the grass. We'd meant to dance forever. That's what we'd meant to do. But the lioness was getting tired, or I was. And the dance started to feel less like a dance and more like a language. And the lioness looked up at me with a tear falling from her massive amber eye and said, "This is it, you know. We won't be getting a second chance." I'm going to finish by reading this deranged mirror image of the first poem, To Be a God. It's called How I Came to Rule the World. And it's taken from a title that's included in this apocryphal story about Mark Strand and Donald Hall and Bob Pack all sitting around drinking red wine each week in Chicago. And they'd come up with these exercises, prompts for themselves, and at the end of the night, at the bottom of the bottle, so to speak, they'd read what they had come up with. And one night, apparently, they all decided to write a poem called How I Came to Rule the World, which I think is very fitting for them, though I never saw any of them published. How I Came to Rule the World. First, no one loved me. Then, I learned to love myself too much. The rest, as they say, is the rest. I ran and ran for what seemed like months, for what seemed like days without nights, without sleep, through stampedes of others, dressed up to look just like me, what I took to be the infernos I'd been promised and had always dreamed of. I prayed for the Lord to take me, until he did. And before I could realize that I was doing it all wrong, I found myself at the edge of an abandoned city. And I said to myself, "This is it." And the wind swelled, so I pulled off a boot. And then some fog dissolved, so I unbuttoned my shirt. And when nothing more could be removed, when nothing more could be left behind, I stood up, wearing nothing but a scarf, and began again to walk, this time toward the glowing center of the city, a piazza of black marble and bare-limbed trees, white, growing like wire from the marble. And there emerged, in bronze curves, oxidized, flaked in mint lichen, right there within the muggy vicinity, a statue of me. And I wept beneath it on my knees, relieved at its being there, but mostly exhausted from the punishment. And that was it. How I came to rule the world? It was easy.
Confronting authors with real questions about the writing process, the difficult and disheartening publishing industry, and why anyone would choose to torture themselves in the world of writing, this is the Literally Podcast with your host, writer, runner, and the literary voice of Ogden, Utah, Case Johnston. Exposing literature, the authors, the business, the process. The Literally Podcast.
This is Case Johnston. We're at Union Station in downtown Ogden, Utah, at historic 25th Street. Today we're talking with Justin Boehning, who just read from his book, Not on the Last Day, but on the Very Last. Daniel Soucy is co-hosting with me today, and we just heard from the book. So, do you have any questions to start it off?
Yeah. So, you mentioned, and I love this. I love how to be a god. Is that the name of this? Is that the title of the
to
poem?
To be a god.
To
yeah.
be a god. That's one of my favorite poems from the collection, and I think I heard you read it when you read in Chicago too. And I really adore that poem, and I like how you mentioned that it was the first poem you wrote after you turned in your MFA thesis. Was it because you finally felt free of the MFA prison, or was it like what? I'm curious why that's such a pivotal moment for you.
I think that handing in that thesis was just such an embarrassment. You know, like the experience of going and writing these poems that I didn't believe in and really couldn't. I can't imagine it happening any other way, frankly. People writing their first books at a MFA program, it just boggles my mind. And
I believe they do, though.
Yeah,
this is gonna go.
No, I believe me. I see it happen all the time. It's like people that walk in and order 4 Big Macs. It just
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's But you know, I felt like simultaneously that I knew I couldn't have completed a book, and also that I had let myself down by not completing one. I'd let my mentors down. I'd let down anyone who invested in me. And I mean, that might be the experience that you have on the day that you hand it in. And in hindsight, you know, I recognize that it's a ridiculous kind of standard to hold anyone to, especially myself, who, you know, probably can never write a good book. But
Did you say you could never write a good book? Except for this one that won the National Poetry Series.
Yeah, this one.
Right, yeah, except for the one, that really good one.
the poem was kind of, I felt extremely liberated. And I felt liberated to be all of a sudden boisterous and funny in a way that I hadn't felt comfortable doing in my MFA thesis, but also really honest. And I felt like I was making promises to someone in that poem that I was going to be a real boy one day, just not today.
Yeah. And where, and I know you have a chapbook that came out before this collection too. Were those poems from your MFA program, or were those, where does that fall in the chronology?
So I included from my MFA thesis in my chapbook, I included none of the poems. And then in my full book, I also included none of them. I could not stand.
I hated my MFA thesis.
Yeah.
I turned it in. It's now bound in the SAIC library, and I hate that it's there when I go steal it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I struggled both with the, like, formatting the table of contents.
Yeah.
You know, that was really difficult.
It's tough.
Everybody had done it, and then I ordered mine in brown.
Yeah.
And I guess you can order them in brown, and so I had to reorder it again.
Microsoft tells you that it'll just do it automatically, but it it doesn't.
No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah.
I went to art school, so we didn't really have tables of contents.
Yeah.
That was fun.
You lucked out.
I did luck out.
That would have put you over the edge.
He has an experimental collection of poems that are unnumbered. That's what I enjoy.
So you wrote that poem on being a god,
yeah,
not on the last day of your MFA,
yeah,
but on the very last,
yeah,
day, right?
Yeah.
So it was the day after you thought it would be over,
yeah,
which I thought was really ironic, which is really,
yeah,
it's fun too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Brandon listens to us, and it seems like we can't go through a podcast without talking about MFA programs. And I think Brandon probably sits there all the time. He's like, why the fuck would you guys put yourself through that?
Brandon will nobody's never go into an MFA program.
No, Brandon's like, well, what are you doing? You know, this doesn't sound right, but yeah.
I should say that I would have never, I don't think I, yeah, I do value the experience I had at the MFA, and I value some of the mentors that I met there, but the idea that you're ever actually going to do something, there's a lot of dissonance going into that experience, and it's at least in part too because of you're pursuing a terminal degree for which there are no jobs at the other end, and that's a little confusing and almost invariably so. I mean, no matter how many times a teacher tells you, "Oh, there will be no job at the end of this," it's tough to hear it. It's tough to understand it, and it's one of those truths that gets more true every day too. So, yeah, they're strange places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're from Iowa City, but you didn't go to Iowa.
No, I'm not from. I'm just living there currently.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm from New York originally. I was born in the Adirondacks, and when I was six, I moved to New York City. Though it never really.
On your own?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I was in the woods. I found this perfect, and then I had the bandana.
On the stick.
Yeah.
Yep. Put all a sandwich in there.
I was adorable.
Yeah,
I was adorable.
Sure you are.
Basically, I did move down by myself, actually. But so I never really felt at home in New York City. So I go back, and my family's still there. And I have a brother who's grown up there, and it's clearly home to him, but I don't have that.
I'm anxious in New York. I feel a lot of anxiety, and like I wish that I loved it more because there's so many wonderful literary events and so many of my literary friends live there too, and I wish that I loved it more, and I wish that I had the patience for it, but there's something about it that feels too chaotic and too congested for me. That's why I moved to Utah.
The opposite, that's for sure. Yeah. I like this idea within that first poem was on being a god is hiding. So it's when I want to give you pain, I know how to do it and then how to find you, and I'm going to. And then when you want to give me pain, where you won't find me, you'll find me. I'm hiding in burning bushes and so on and so forth, where you can't reach me. Where did you come up with that? I was thinking. Maybe is that the MFA too?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had had someone who was important to me and who just, and I needed her. I needed her guidance, especially during that time at trying to become a poet. And yeah, during that, writing that poem, I felt like, I simultaneously wanted to do right by her, and at the same time felt really injured by her not being there whenever I needed her. And I mean, this is the relationship we have with God, at least we Jews. And also I think too that it kind of stood in for that feeling that I go back to when I'm writing a poem, which is distance from the thing that I'm just trying to reach toward, or I know I won't be able to find or see or hold. But yeah, it kind of stood in for the essential poetry experience for me. So it was
powerful. It stuck with me immediately. And lots of times I go through a whole podcast and don't take out my pen. But today, immediately in the first poem, I wanted to write a few things down, you know, and maybe someday steal it in one way or another, you know, take it into my own writing.
You should.
You know, mine will be in prose, so you won't know, you know, we'll start with one line, and then, you know, 4 pages later, we'll say, well.
Well, actually, that poem, too, the refrain, it's all stolen. It comes from the last stanza in Domestic Mysticism, which is the first poem in Lucy Brock-Bredow's first book. And she repeats that twice. I'll do this as a God does this. I'll do this as a God does this. And I thought, wow, that's like, yeah. And it just the hubris required really spoke to me. I was like, God, this is what I'm doing wrong. I'm being way too humble in there. I gotta start showing off the guns.
But I also appreciate that poem in that it's a God and not just God, right? So it's the allowance of multiple gods or conflicting gods or gods that work in tandem with one another. And so I like, you know, I feel like the gods that I am familiar with in a pluralistic sense are Greco-Roman or Norse. And so each of them not only have their strengths, but they have their sort of flaws too. Mm-hmm. And so I really did appreciate this poem for that aspect too. And I'm sure you were conscious of that too when you were writing it, but he's nodding. Just because we're on a podcast, I can't see you nodding. No, you're okay. So yeah, I really enjoy that too. And that the poem is saying that you're not almighty, right? In your action.
Yeah, it's a remarkably vulnerable speaker, I think.
I think it adds a much larger question, too. Just thinking about what you were saying is, what happened to us when we went away from gods that had vulnerabilities? You know, when we've gone to the Western world, to gods who are perfect. And what happens to the way that that reflects on us as human beings, or putting ourselves up to perfect gods and never being able to become those perfect gods? Well, unless you're LDS, and you'll find that. I did say that we are in Utah, which means you can be a god, and you will have your own planet.
Eventually.
It's called LSD.
Actually. It is LSD. Yeah, yes, LSD. Absolutely. Yes. That was my religion in college.
Our Mormon listeners will love
it. We don't have many of them.
Really?
I don't think so. They're gone. They're gone now.
Okay.
Yeah.
They left 5 minutes ago.
Well, you know, what's really funny about that is, and this is a side note, that I think the LDS people have a pretty nice, good sense of humor about themselves.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We saw Book of Mormon on Broadway last in January, but then we saw it here at Pioneer Theater in Salt Lake. And the laughs here with an LDS crowd were so much larger than in New York, because they were able to say, "Yeah, that's my brother," or "That's my," or "That's me," and it was, yeah, it's really interesting. That's a side note. But this poem ties, like you said, ties to the last poem that you read too about
how I came to rule the world.
Right, how I came to rule the world.
Yeah,
where do you place those in the book?
Well, they're kind of bookends, not mm-hmm. quite. Entirely, but pretty close to the front, which is to be a god, and pretty close to the end, how I came to rule the world. And I do think that they're very different, and I wrote how I came to rule the world also toward the end of writing the book, and it kind of shows maybe, if not a progression, at least, you know, the shift that happened and what kind of idiom I was attracted mm-hmm. to. They're different. Mm-hmm. One's kind of a little parable. The other is very lyric and musical. But yeah, I enjoyed that they could so clearly echo one another and explicitly go after that same kind of hubris and at the same time really collide and show the tension in the book. Or
That film for me was important, especially understanding the meaning behind it too, because so having moved here from Chicago, there was a lot of that happening, right? There was a lot of the sort of let's meet and have some drinks and write some poems together in the same way that was happening in Paris and in different little sects around the world. And so I think that poem for me is not only the mirror image of the first poem that you read, but it's also this sort of close alignment or like tribute to literary companionship or literary collaboration. Sorry, I was trying to think of the word collaboration. And so it's fascinating to think about how the drawing from a poem that was written by multiple people can then become something new and original by one person.
No, I mean, I think part of it, part of what made it important for me to write, at least off of that one, was Mark Strand's connection to it. Mark came to visit University of Montana when I was there as an undergrad, and I immediately despised him. He was so handsome and just
it's reason number one.
Yeah.
I hate you because you're beautiful.
Yeah, everything he said sounded just like the truth. Yeah. And that was the case with his poems too. There was a smugness to them, and you know, they were so debonair and confident, and they seemed to require no effort on his part, which, you know, I found to be really insulting, especially at the time being, you know, a punk kid who was struggling for every word as far as I was concerned. So when I went to Columbia, which is where I did my MFA, he was there. And I avoided him like the plague, just never really having revisited my initial impressions of him. And I ended up taking a seminar with him because a couple of my friends had signed up for it on Kafka. And again, I just found him to be really difficult to deal with. He would hold class for half the time we were supposed to meet, and you know, he never seemed terribly hardworking in other ways too. In his reading, it was never very erudite, but the truth is, you know, he was so intuitive, and he really saw those texts in ways that, you know, I've never read anyone else. It took me until after he was kind of out of my reach to really appreciate him. And I started reading his collected repeatedly. And I felt this huge sense of failure that I had been given access to this person who I had grown to admire more, really almost more than anyone else. And I had failed. I had failed to see the value in what he was doing and his very unique views on literature and the world. I mean, he was a quiet iconoclast. And so I felt like I owed it to him. Mm-hmm. And the story finishes, the apocryphal story. His poem was "How I Came to Rule the World." It was easy. That was the whole poem. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well,
absolutely. Slide
that
in. That
one deserves to be in there.
Yeah. So what do you think, where do poets belong today in a world where our president just kept the New York Times, CNN, and Politico out of his press conference? Where are our voices? I'm not a poet, but where are your voices?
Well, for me, poetry before Trump was important because it allowed me to acknowledge and try to communicate with something I know is there, but I can't ever quantify. And I know that those are spiritual terms. For me, poetry remains essentially a spiritual undertaking. And it was valuable to me, just totally essential before Trump. And because it was valuable before Trump, it remains valuable now in the same way, and maybe more so. I think that it's easy to lose faith in your need for those kinds of conversations when there are so many other things in the world that are demanding your action. But I think that it's totally required, necessary, that we stay nourished in the way that art and poetry can nourish us. So,
especially with threats to the NEH and the NEA too, that it scares me because I'm a writer who works in a museum, and so those are both really critical funding points for us. But not even just funding points; they're sort of like these monuments to the art and into culture, and it definitely terrifies me. I thought your first question would be where do poets belong, and just full stop. And I wouldn't have had an answer to that. But I think in general, I've felt more pressure. I haven't written since November, and I've felt more pressure to sort of include more political content or discourse in my work, and that it doesn't necessarily feel natural. Like I studied political science in school, and it was something that it's something I've always been very passionate about, but I've just never met the two. Mm-hmm. And I'm still trying to figure out how to write about the current political climate or the effects of the current political climate, which are indeed more important to me than the actual people who are in office. But I'm still trying to figure it out, to be completely honest with you. I feel more pressure to be more political, but I'm not entirely sure how to do it.
Or figure out how to do it without feeling the pressure.
Yeah.
Right? Like maybe,
or just like continue,
go back to where you were.
Or to continue writing in the same way that I was writing. Right. When there's a sort of alarm going off saying, why aren't you being more proactive about this kind of thing? And yeah, so I don't know. I'm struggling.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough. I mean, of course I feel the same draw.
Would you consider your work political?
I think everything is political. I don't think about our current political situation when I'm writing poems.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's like, so I've been running this press with my fiance, Devin Walker Figueroa, and we've been working pretty much around the clock because, you know, we're writers too. Mm-hmm. She's in an MFA at Iowa, so she's finishing her thesis. Terrified.
I've never heard of that workshop.
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah. Yeah. She's enduring gracefully.
Well?
Yeah. Okay. We have a very similar illness. Between Horse Thief, you know, the magazine and our press and writing ourselves and anything else, you know, we were waking up, getting to work and going to bed early in the morning. You know, really every day. And after a while, we're like, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. I mean, we are totally committed, devoted, and I think the way that one needs to be to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, we have to remain nourished in these other ways. We have to go eat falafels.
Mm-hmm.
It's required.
Absolutely.
We have to go to the movies. We have to see other people. We have to remain in contact with our friends and family. And I think, you know, that's the important thing for me, that I'm reminding myself when I'm going back and writing poems, is that these are the falafels that we need. Falafels were good before Trump, totally required. Mm-hmm. They're required now. And trying to find other ways of remaining involved and active, which is a word that I used previously, and you know, make sure that I'm keeping lines of dialogue open, yeah, in other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and because you mentioned Horse Thief, maybe we should talk about that.
Sure.
First of all, I knew you were getting married, but congrats again. Okay. I'll say it publicly, congrats.
Thank you.
Are you guys going to have poems read at your wedding? To talk about that?
You know,
are you guys going to write each other some poems?
No, it's going to be a very small and casual thing at a wine bar.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
I'll come if you want. No, I'm just kidding.
we have two vans casually. Available.
Yeah, we're going
to take us to Iowa.
That's a reference. Justin's also been traveling around in a van promoting his lovely new book. So, yeah, that was a... people in on the inside joke.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, like, tell people a little bit more about Horse Thief, and because it was initially just a journal, right? Mm-hmm. And then it developed into a press as well,
Yeah. So our idea was always to have the press. And I mean, truth be told, I never felt like, oh God, what we really need is another online poetry journal. Right. I did think that we could do something that was a little different, and I think that we've done that. We create, first of all, it's a monthly, which is insane, and I don't recommend it to any editor, but we collect 20 to 30 pages of poetry every month. And when I say pages, you know, these are very small pages. We create this digital reading experience that emulates the book. So you flip through it page to page. You never scroll up or down. Mm-hmm. We think that, you know, there's wisdom in the book as a form, that you have to turn the page, that it has a clear beginning and an end. These are, you know, this is some of the wisdom that is in the line, the poetic line. So we wanted to create something that would remain faithful to, you know, that belief. But we really just did the magazine so people would be aware of, you know, what our aesthetic values were. Mm-hmm. We wanted people to get to know us and what kind of conversation we were interested in having editorially, aesthetically. And we timed it so that about after a year was done, we would be releasing our first books. And with the books, similarly, but also maybe a little different, is that I'm a little weird in that I don't mind so much reading digitally. Mm-hmm. Most poets, they really fetishize this book object.
I hate reading. I can't e-read.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Especially poetry.
I'm like, I'm a unicorn in this way. But I also do really love the book. My feeling, however, is that if we're going to continue to publish these books, they have to be as durable as the literature inside of them. So we're committed to making hardcover books. So that's what we did. We put out two hardcover poetry collections.
And they're beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We're pretty happy with them.
Yeah, good. I'm glad.
Yeah. Michael Bizet's this second book, and Elizabeth Scanlon, it's improbably her debut. It's clearly been hammered on. The thing is a gem.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah,
I like her work quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, both of them are truly wonderful. I had no idea what we would fall into when we started it. We've been, I guess anyone would say this, but I was astonished at the quality of the work that we received. Mm-hmm. And it really, I feel like it just goes to show you how important publishers of collections are.
Yeah.
I mean, more of those need to be in the world.
Yeah, well, I think, too, it might be a testament to people trusting you and Devin too, and people understanding your aesthetic and understanding like, great, this is the kind of press that we want to be with. And these are the kind of people because we like their work, you know, whether it's your editing work or your actual written work. And I think the two are very closely connected too. And so I'm sure that you're getting good books because you guys are talented people too. And you have a very clear passion and aesthetic. So that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, you're surprised, but I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I wouldn't trust me. It's all,
cut that, Brandon. We want you to get great submissions, eliminate them.
Yeah, no, it's whatever we've done. It's really worked. We continue to get great submissions for the magazine, and we've got great submissions again for next year's catalog. And look forward to continuing to do it.
How many books a year are you thinking about putting out? Two, three?
Two for each This first year and then the next. We're also going to do a couple chapbooks. Yeah. And which are also going to be, they're going to be kind of hard bound as well, but homespun, made in a basement in Tucson. It's going to be legit.
It better be a basement.
It better be. It better be.
If I find out that you made them somewhere else, not in Tucson, and above ground, yeah. I'm going to be livid.
I will send you the photos.
Good.
The
photo. I want them.
Yeah. Your authenticity would be shot. Completely shot.
Just to start out. I mean, it's tough. The costs of publishing in hardcover, of course, are really high. So we have to be really conservative as we build the catalog.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to share with anybody reading before we wrap it up?
I think I've been sufficiently...
What about contact info for the press?
Oh, yeah. Horsethiefbooks.com is the website, and you can always just fire me off an email at justin@horsethiefbooks.com.
Great. And for the book?
That's at my website, not on the last day, but on the very last. You can get it through Milkweed Editions, also Amazon, but you know.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, go to Milkweed.
Books, yeah, or Milkweed.
Yeah,
freaking publisher. Yeah, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. They like
it. Go to EWP and buy it from their table.
They like it when you do that.
Yeah, that's a nice way to go. Well, thanks so much for having. We're having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having
thanks
me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm thanks so so glad
you
ran
this, Justin.
This is Justin Boehning with the podcast. Literally, just joking. Okay, thanks.
Good joke.
Where's the end? Where's the line?
The end.
The end.
The end.
Finn.
Oh, that's
thank you, you guys.